Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Well, will Me Too fell Madigan, the longest lording State House Speaker in U.S. history, is in the crosshairs again as it relates to staff, senior staff, his longtime implementation tool, Tim Mapes, chief of staff, resigning yesterday in the wake of complaints by one Sherry Garrett, a $42,000 a year account technician in state government, allegations by Ms. Garrett that Tim Mapes made inappropriate comments to her.
Oh, yeah, he'd ask her, hey, do you have a pink bra underneath that shirt? At one function, he went up to her and said that.
And also when she suggested that there were inappropriate comments directed by other legislators to her, he dismissed them. He didn't kind of level them up for any sort of investigation. It was remarkable. I mean, Mapes has been with Madigan for a long
Forever.
Time. And it was remarkable how fast it happened. There was this announcement that there was going to be a press conference at 11 with a new accuser making new allegations against a new target. Mapes was identified at about 11 o'clock. A couple hours later, Madigan released a statement saying that at my direction, Tim Mapes has resigned as my chief of staff and clerk of the Illinois House of Representatives.
And as director of the Democratic Party of Illinois.
Treasurer, right.
Yeah.
And so it's really interesting. This is now, what, number four in 4 months within Madigan's
circle
orbit, mm-hmm. right? So you had Elena Hampton against a Madigan field goon. You had Lou Lang, obviously his deputy majority leader, who has not resigned. He's fighting the accusations against him made by Marianne Lancour last week. We had her on the show.
And certain people just stepped down from their position, their leadership positions, rather than resign. But this is the first time.
That's what he did, right.
And then
you had Kelly Cassidy, state rep,
yep.
And now you've got Mapes. Could this be the end of Madigan? I remember what I said when we were talking about Lancour, and even previously with Cassidy. Could the Me Too movement, as blunt an instrument as it is, could it actually do for Illinois what the Republican Party is unwilling to do, what the Illinois electorate has been unmotivated to do, which is reorder the political power structure in this state? Sherry Garrett yesterday at the press conference outlining her complaints and allegations.
Over the course of the last several years, I have endured and have personally witnessed bullying and repeated harassment that was often sexual and sexist in nature in my workplace. In my case, this harassment has taken place at the highest levels in the State House. Tim Mapes, Chief of Staff to Speaker Madigan, has made repeated inappropriate comments to me and around me, both in the office and on the House floor. I have decided to come forward this morning because we have a serious and pervasive problem in our state government, and I could no longer remain silent about my own mistreatment. My hope is that by coming forward, I can create space for others to do the same. Mr. Mapes is the chief of staff to the...
And now, remember a little bit more of the backstory here in terms of what's transpired over the last 6 to 8 months. You had 300-plus women who work in and around state government in Springfield signed this letter last year talking about the culture of sexual harassment in Springfield. So far, effectively, three have come forward. So there's a lot more women, I suspect, with a lot more stories to tell. And I'm not suggesting at all that it's limited to Mike Madigan and his henchmen. And I'm not suggesting it's limited at all to the Democrats.
Yeah, I mean,
but there's a lot more women out there.
There are. And they're going to keep coming forward. And I hope that they do, because they talked about, you know, he accused them of, she accused him of inappropriate comments about her clothing that I mentioned, the pink bra, and made jokes about sexual harassment training that they all had to attend.
The only way as an employee to see Speaker Madigan is you have to make an appointment through Tim.
And that's why she wanted to go to him, but she couldn't because she had to go to Tim, the person who was making sexually inappropriate comments.
Tim Mates said, completely out of nowhere, that I needed to make sure that I was not showing my pink bra to the judge during Inauguration Day, because he knows how the girls who work on the second floor like to leave little to the imagination.
She described it as a, you know, a men's locker room mentality. That was the environment she was working in.
You also had her talking about Ms. Garrett make an allegation against former state representative Ken Duncan.
Oh, yeah. Who now is on the Water Reclamation Board, right?
I want to take, he said, according to her and another woman, I want to take both of you home and see which one will be the naughtiest.
There's that word you don't like. Naughty.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's like, it's like moist. It's just one of those words I don't, God, especially when a guy says naughty. Oh, God.
But I'm a woman, so it's not as bad. But especially for him to say that, who's going up to two ladies? Can you imagine? Duncan, now, who's the naughtiest? Come on, ladies.
Yeah, I've heard comments from about Duncan's comments before. So that's not exactly, I would say, out of character for him, unfortunately. By the way, Ken Duncan, former Democrat state rep, but a Republican appointee to the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District. Governor Rauner appointed Ken Duncan to the MWRD, okay. And now yesterday Governor Rauner suggested that his recent appointee to the MWRD should resign.
Yes. So he used to be, so the state rep, Ken Duncan, Democrat, now Republican. All right.
He's not a Republican. I'm saying he was appointed by Rauner.
Yes. But Jeannie Ives weighed in on this because, your time has come, Democrats.
The Democrats have a real problem in this culture of sexual harassment, and it's not going to get changed with Speaker Madigan in charge.
She's not the only one saying that. The Chicago Tribune editorial board chiming in. The Me Too hypocrites of Springfield. When will Democrat members, especially those who make a public show of their opposition to harassment, grow a spine? They're all about Me Too when it's trendy, just not when it actually matters.
And when it's on their doorstep.
Casper in West Chicago, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, good morning, Dan, Amy.
Hi.
I can't believe it. It's like here in CNN, the part of CNN, fake news, you know? When Trump do something like this and CNN say something about it, what you say? It's just fake news. You just want to say something to punish this poor man. You know, Madigan is doing a lot of good for this state. Come on, man. You can do this to this very good man like Trump. Trump has been doing this for 12 women right now.
Casper, can
I? What you say? What
Casper,
somebody say
Casper,
about Trump?
Casper, can I say something? Can I say something to you?
It's a lover.
Casper,
so
you know.
Right now,
Casper,
so right now,
Casper,
two more men is good for you.
Yeah, Casper.
But what is Trump is not good for you.
Yeah, Casper. Now I'm talking. Now I'm talking, Casper.
Yeah. Go ahead.
You know, Oh, I guess I'm not talking. Okay, Casper.
Okay,
now you're not talking. Bye. I have a great affinity for Casper.
I love Casper too. Pueblo Unido jamás hará vencido.
I find him hilarious. Just set that up. But if you say that Mike Madigan has done a little good for this state,
well, you must be living on the border of Wisconsin.
Well, I just don't think there's much more for us to talk about. If for people who believe that Mike Madigan has been a force for good in the state for the last four decades.
Even liberal Democrats know that he's not been good for this state.
You're why this state is the worst governed state in the history of America. Casper in West Chicago, case in point. We can talk about Madigan, and his time will come, and he will go, and that will be great. But the real problem in Illinois is Casper in West Chicago. Do you understand that? Mike Madigan has done a lot of good for this state. Robert in Oak Brook.
Laughable. Yeah, real quick, a question for you. If you get fired, do you get a pension? But if you resign, and that's got to be one heck of a pension. I mean, is that and real quick, Penthouse Forum is listening real carefully, going, God, I got my next article.
Yeah, right. Thanks for the call, Robert. Mapes is set for a $125,000 starting pension. Yeah. Starting pension.
I mean, you know it's bad if Laura Washington, who's a liberal, and she's a political analyst for ABC 7, says this.
I think he's more vulnerable than he's ever been before. The Me Too movement has brought down many more powerful men than him.
That's true. Yeah. Dan in Libertyville.
Good morning, Dan, Amy. Hey, you guys got to have more Casper on here. That guy is hilarious. That's the best gut laugh I've had in years.
He's a riot. There's no question. Thanks, Dan.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Hey, Joe Walsh here. Did you know that London is kind of like becoming the murder capital of the world? We'll talk about it when Freedom returns at 5.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Yesterday, after a meeting with Kim Kardashian at the White House last week,
yes,
President Trump decided to honor Kim's request, I guess, to commute the sentence of one Alice Johnson, who was serving a 25-year life sentence with no possibility of parole for her role in a drug laundering operation.
Yeah, she was arrested
in Memphis.
Yeah, possession of cocaine and money laundering. But a lot of people say, no, she was in charge of a drug cartel. But for some reason, Kim Kardashian and her husband, Kanye West, became involved in this case, wanted, you know, to make sure that she got out. So, yeah, Kim Kardashian has a lot of reality TV star power. And I'm upset this morning because I think President Trump's priorities are out of line. I think he should have pardoned Rod Blagojevich first because his daughter is graduating from Northwestern this weekend. And
I don't know what one has to do with the other. It's the merits of the case. It's not, you know, what's going on in your family's life.
Or
that's not the basis for a commutation or a pardon, but okay.
Yeah, but I
know,
so
you
like
just
he's
want
catering,
him out regardless. But
he's catering to celebrities. I mean, Sylvester Stallone was behind the Jack Johnson pardon push. And now, so in the, and he did the photo op with him in the Oval Office.
Yeah, maybe get Chloe Kardashian to go to bat with POTUS for Blago, maybe. But here's the thing. Yes, there's some celebrity that's associated with this, and maybe that's the difference maker for Trump. But the merits of the case. So Jack Johnson was wrongly prosecuted.
I agree that he should have been pardoned.
Right.
Possibly.
So on the merits, there's not a lot of disagreement, or there shouldn't be. Alice Johnson is an interesting case, too. Catherine Timpf has a good piece in National Review on it. When she got involved in the drug business, she was going through, she had divorced in 1989. In 1990, she lost her job at FedEx, which she had had for a decade because of a gambling addiction. She couldn't pay her bills, filed for bankruptcy. Her house was foreclosed on. Then in 92, her youngest son was killed in a motorcycle accident.
Oh.
That she said was the last straw for her. She decided to start making money in a way that she later regretted. I went into complete panic, and out of desperation, I made one of the worst decisions of my life to make some quick money. She has acknowledged wrongdoing, which distinguishes her from Blagojevich, by the way. I want this to be clear. I acknowledge that I have done wrong. I made the biggest mistake of my life to make ends meet and got involved with people selling drugs.
Okay. And she's forever grateful to President Trump. I don't know if you saw her when she got out of prison. She had on this white outfit, and she literally ran across the street with her arms up in the air screaming. It was really just a moment of jubilation. And she's very appreciative to President Trump.
Well, I want to say to President Trump, I am going to make you proud that you gave me this second chance in life, and I will not disappoint the American public or the world who has so much faith in me. All I can say is thank you, President Trump. And I love you, President Trump. Thank you. And I want to tell Kim, my war angel, that every gave up on me. You never gave up your fight. You were relentless, and it has paid off beautifully for me and my family on this day.
Also, again, what kind of prisoner was she in terms of the calculation on the commutation? She became an ordained minister and mentor, playwright, and a counselor. She spent time with inmates who were suicidal. She didn't have a single disciplinary infraction on her record during her 21 years in prison.
Yeah, model inmate, so that's good.
She has vowed to continue to help people behind bars when she's released. She even insisted that she'd have a job ready if she ever got out previously. And so you're talking about somebody who was, you know, the whole, like, nonviolent drug offender thing is a bit of a misnomer as far as I'm concerned. You're involved in a violent business. Because you didn't commit violence, you're still facilitating violence. So, yeah.
It helps that she's a great grandma. It helps that she was an exemplary, you know, prison inmate.
Yes, it all helps. And I think there this is a fairly compelling case for a commutation after 21 years. I'm just saying some of the celebration is a little too aggressive for me. You know, the kind of the ACLU definition of nonviolent drug offender is less than forthright. But you know, the point here is that it's hard to argue with the merits of the two cases, even against the backdrop of suggestions that Trump is using his pardon power only for celebrity or in response to celebrity, sort of the same thing, and or to take shots at Team Mueller and all of the enemies of the Trump administration.
Yeah, they believe it is an overreach of government, overreach of the Justice Department for some felons who were, you know, convicted on drug convictions to spend their entire lives in prison.
Well, right. But there's so the issue is Trump using his pardon power judiciously and responsibly? 312-642-5600 turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA turnkey.pro text line. By the way, before, you know, Rocky came for Jack Johnson or Kim came for Alice Johnson, there were efforts previously to level up these cases for consideration for a pardon in the Jack Johnson case and a commutation in the Alice Johnson case. So it's not like this is just because or this is the first time or somehow these cases got moved to the front of people of the president's attention. Just because of Stallone and Kardashian, they were around, kicking around their efforts before because these cases are pretty solid on the merits. Dinesh D'Souza, maybe a bit of a different story.
Maybe. Do you think he should have been pardoned?
I think that's a bit of a different story. I think
To elaborate?
He admitted he did wrong.
Right.
We've talked to him before. It wasn't like a screw up. It was
calculated and planned.
Well, it was knowingly acting to subvert campaign finance laws. So that's a crime. I mean, is it usually prosecuted as aggressively as it was by Preet Bharara in New York against D'Souza? Was the prosecution, did that have a political overtone? Sure. Should these crimes, campaign finance violations like D'Souza committed, should they be felonies so that you have a felony record? Arguably not. However, that's not the way the rule of law works. If you want to change that, then you should change the campaign finance laws and the associated penalties, which I would be supportive of, by the way. But pardoning D'Souza's conviction, he wasn't wrongly prosecuted. He may have been more aggressively prosecuted than someone without his profile or his political leanings would have been. But he wasn't wrongly prosecuted.
And does this, does this help President Trump's image of, you know, people say he's a racist and he hates minorities? Does this help with that? Could this attract African-Americans to the Republican Party?
I don't know. I mean, the left is never going to stop. It doesn't matter what he does. He's Hitler, racist, Ku Klux Klan member, white supremacist, alt-right. I mean, it doesn't matter what he does because they just use those terms, the isms and the phobias, in lieu of arguments. They're just the left just does branding campaigns. They don't make arguments.
They
don't take policy positions. They just seek to vilify their enemies, trumping at the top of that list. So I don't know how much currency it has, but maybe. I mean, you know, if you have ambassadors out there, this case is going to get a lot of attention. There's right now, there's a lot of push across party lines for criminal justice reform, alternative sentencing for the quote-unquote nonviolent drug offenders and so forth.
Jared Kushner is working on that.
So, yeah, but I mean, that's happening at the state level, too, and it's been going on for a while. And so the point is, you know, could this be a goodwill gesture to a segment of the population that feels like the deck is stacked against them, that they don't have equal justice before the law, that the penalties are more harsh on black drug offenders than on white drug offenders, and there's some evidence to support that claim, perhaps.
Guess where Alice Johnson had her first meal? At the Red Lobster. And Kim Kardashian thanked President Trump.
You know, I think in life, everyone makes mistakes, and she really deserves a second chance. Mm-hmm.
Just like Kim Kardashian has had a second and third chance at marriage.
That the placeholder, right? What was he? The basketball player, the NBA guy?
Yeah, he doesn't matter.
Huh. Is he even in the NBA?
You got that guy. Mm-hmm. You got...
I think she's on too.
Well, I'm thinking of Ray J, right? The sex tape.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Who is Ray J? Is he a rapper or an athlete?
He was a rapper. Oh. I mean, I don't know if he's ever actually had any songs. I'm not sure. I just remember that mainly. But that's also why I mainly remember Kim Kardashian. So I guess.
So the Trump meeting Rump summit paid off.
Did Rump go to Red Lobster with Alice? No?
No, she went with her great-grandchildren and everybody. They all went to Red Lobster. Huh. What would be your first meal after 20 years in prison? I think I'd want a gyro.
Really?
Five Faces. Oh, yeah. Hmm. With extra fries. Large Diet Coke. Not that I've thought about it.
I'd probably go to Oven Grinder for the pizza.
Oh, yeah. But you have to pay that guy to get in.
I hope I... never have to wait 21 years for the Oven Grinder.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Well, House Speaker Paul Ryan's response to questions about Spygate has gotten a lot of press attention over the last 24 hours because the D.C. press narrative is this summed up nicely in this Politico headline. Ryan undercuts Trump on Russia at fraught moment. Did Paul Ryan really undercut the president? The questions that have been raised about the FBI informant that was embedded in the Trump campaign, did he undercut him or did he just respond to a question about that informant based on what he believes to be true at this point, pending another intelligence briefing that he is going to be part of next week? Here's Paul Ryan.
Normally, I don't like to comment on classified briefings. Let me say it this way. I think Chairman Gowdy's initial assessment is accurate. But we have some more digging to do. We're waiting for some more document requests. We have some more documents to review. We still have some unanswered questions. But I have seen no evidence to the contrary of the initial assessment that Chairman Gowdy has made. But I want to make sure that we run every lead down and make sure we get final answers to these questions.
Yeah, and the Department of Justice has agreed to release more documents for lawmakers to see and form an opinion.
There's a gang of eight briefing for scheduled today. For early next week.
Oh, okay. All right. I mean, does Trump have egg on his face? Is this bad for President Trump? I mean, everybody said, no, there's no Russian spy. The FBI was vigilant and they were responsible and they did what they needed to do by putting this person in there to make sure they weren't messing with the election.
Well, everyone's not saying that. Some people are saying that. And Trey Gowdy essentially said last week, at this point, the American people would be proud of what the FBI has done. The FBI did what they should have done. But that's not a unanimous opinion. There's some Republicans who are echoing that. Paul Ryan just did. Mm-hmm. Richard Burr on the Senate side did. But Devin Nunes, chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, did not. And, you know, Paul Ryan may, you know,
well, Trey
share
Gow-
the position.
Trey Gowdy and Paul Ryan are on their way out. I don't know if that means anything or if that plays into anything.
Richard Burr is not.
Okay.
So the issue is access to information. Some have, others don't have. But I thought Paul Ryan's statement is still measured, particularly when you consider how it's being reported with froth in the mouth of Anderson Cooper yesterday when he was talking about this, for example. And you have another briefing scheduled. And the point of the whole Spygate investigation and the documents requests and the questions that are being answered is to get questions answered. It's to understand exactly what Mr. Halper was doing, not doing, to whom he was reporting, what he was reporting. So, you know, Trump's imprecise tweets aside, there are legitimate questions about, well, there are legitimate questions like I just asked that are being asked, and they demand answers from the FBI. And I don't think the FBI deserves the benefit of the doubt on this stuff at this stage, not the FBI as it existed under Jim Comey. And that's the point. So they can hoop and holler all they want about Paul Ryan's statement or Trey Gowdy's last week. That doesn't eliminate the need for those questions to be answered and for those in positions of authority to convey those answers for public consumption. Speaking of which, Jim Comey's FBI, there's also a report out yesterday that the Inspector General, the DOJ Inspector General's report on Comey and Lynch is going to be critical. One source told ABC News the draft report explicitly used the word insubordinate to describe Comey's behavior. In a draft report, Inspector General Michael Horowitz also rebuked former Attorney General Loretta Lynch for her handling of the federal investigation into Hillary Clinton's personal email server. So,
did you mention anything about her talk with Bill Clinton on the private jet?
Well, you know, this is the kind of the inside dope on what the report is going to say. It hasn't been released yet. But so if Comey, the FBI director, and the Attorney General of the United States, if they don't get a clean bill of health from the Department of Justice Inspector General in the context of everything we're talking about, what the FBI and DOJ was doing vis-a-vis the Trump campaign in 2016, now do you think there's some legitimacy to the questions that are being asked and the answers that are being requested? I think so. The whole kind of it's nothing or it's the end of the world. How about instead of drawing conclusions based on information we don't have, we ask the right questions and we wait for the answers? And the demagoguery, to some extent on both sides, notwithstanding, just keep asking the same questions. Because until somebody can answer those questions for me, then I'm not persuaded of anything. And against or the backdrop or with the context of these reports that are coming out by the watchdog, how McCabe acted, a referral for a possible criminal prosecution of the deputy director of the FBI, Comey's number two man. That's what Horowitz did, the inspector general. Now we have this, the contents of his forthcoming report on Comey being telegraphed.
It's great because it vindicates President Trump's, you know, official reasoning for fire Comey, for firing him. So, I mean, he looks
insubordinate.
There was
yes.
Right, insubordination. That's
yes.
A reason to fire somebody.
No question about it.
312-642-5600 is our turnkey.pro answer line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Pete in Montgomery, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. So yesterday I only heard once a news blurb that Andrew McCabe offered to testify before Congress with being granted immunity. So does this indicate that there's that the FBI investigation into Trump and the Hillary email debacle, House of Cards, is about to collapse?
Well, thanks for the call, Pete.
It's leaked information in a yet-to-be-released report.
Right. I mean, you want to withhold judgment. I mean, it's one thing to say, here's a couple of nuggets from the report or the draft report.
Yeah, but you didn't see this on CNN this morning or last night. About James Comey?
No, they were.
I didn't see anything about the cake maker for hours. They didn't even talk about it. They pretended as if it didn't exist because it didn't fit in with their narrative.
Right. I mean, it's
that's
all.
Made me so upset.
They're in full, you know, high dungeon over Paul Ryan's statement. They didn't have time to focus on anything else the mind share. Speaking of, by the way, forthrightness and honesty, since this is sort of the argument against the Trump administration, fake news.
Everybody's throwing that around.
Another report that came out yesterday that's relevant. The Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, led by Ohio Senator Rob Portman, released a majority report reviewing the Obama administration's communications and financial maneuverings with Iranian officials at the time of the Iran nuclear deal, which, of course, President Trump withdrew from to the hysterics of the left. The report, this is the Weekly Standard coverage, reveals in fuller detail the duplicitous ways in which the Obama administration sold the agreement. As part of the plan, according to the testimony of several Obama-era officials, including Treasury Secretary Jack Lew, Iran was to be denied access to the U.S. dollar and U.S. banking system. The administration's message was clear both before and after the deal signing. Iran would not be given access to the U.S. financial system, yet the administration circumvented its own stated policy. When Obama-era officials were questioned by lawmakers about whether Iran would have access to the U.S. banking system, those administrations failed to disclose that, in fact, they had already facilitated Iran's access to the U.S. banking system. They issued a license permitting Iran to convert $5.7 billion held in Oman from Omani rials to U.S. dollars and then into euros. That would have directly violated the sanctions law then in place, as well as the terms of the Iran nuclear deal. Obama officials asked U.S. banks to break the law, and the banks said no. That's the only reason the transaction didn't take place. Oh. Obama administration officials asked the U.S. banks to break the law, sanctions against Iran, the terms of their own deal with Iran, and the banks said no. That's why the transaction didn't happen. And they lied to Congress about it.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
And yet here's the main echo chamber creator, Ben Rhodes, on with Andrea Mitchell yesterday, talking about his real concerns about the Trump administration and Russian collusion and ahead of the 2020 election. And the concern he has is the government's inability to edit Facebook. They couldn't edit Facebook in 2016. That was a problem. Now that's a concern for him, that they can't do it, that the government can't come in and edit Facebook. So Facebook will do it for themselves, including, by the way, launching new news products, which is was out yesterday. But listen to Ben Rhodes, the communications guy behind the Iran deal, who is facilitating all of this lying to Congress and to the American people.
Part of what I look back on and wonder about is when there was a statement of warning, it was about the hacking and releasing of emails. It didn't really address the fake news, the fact that people's social media feeds are being polluted by this Russian-created content favoring Donald Trump. And, you know, and I think what he would argue, President Obama, we'd say to him this question, do you need to go out and say this yourself? He would say, look, I get asked about this when I'm in the briefing room. We've warned them. I amplify those warnings when I'm asked about it. But I'm not a messenger that people who are consuming that stuff will listen to. And Trump will say it's rigged. And frankly, the government also didn't have a lot of capacity to deal with this. You know, we can't edit people's Facebook feeds and say that's fake news and that's not. And what worries me today, Andrea, is that we still don't have a lot of capacity, and frankly, our government's probably not doing anything to prevent this. And so the likelihood that the Russians are going to do this again in the midterm elections and the next presidential election is very high.
I mean, President Obama should never have used access to our financial system as a bargaining chip.
Well, he said he didn't.
Well, there's proof that proves otherwise.
And then he did.
And then he did.
Kevin in Libertyville.
Oh, my.
Good morning, guys. Hey, it might be time for us to pull. I'll put on our tinfoil hats, but it's weird. Every day I wake up and I read all about this, and I'm jail. But do you remember a few weeks back, John Brennan said, hey, you Republicans, you better get your act together, get Trump in line, or there's going to be consequences. And then, I don't know if you've noticed it, but I have. All of a sudden, in the last week or so, the Marco Rubio and Trey Gowdy and a few others have just, like, gone radio silent. Devin Nunes is completely gone, and everyone's, like, backing away. And you just wonder, is that somehow connected? And you look at that, and you just think, can it possibly be? And I just wondered, Dan, if you noticed that as well.
Well, thanks for the call, Kevin. I don't know. I connected to what, you know, what I guess what my question would be, what is afoot, or what do you think is afoot? I see Devin Nunes. Devin Nunes was out last week responding to, he was on, I don't know, one of the Fox shows, responding to the comments Trey Gowdy made. So he's around, and he's going to be part of that Gang of Eight briefing that happens next week. More questions and hopefully get answered, more documents produced to support those answers per Paul Ryan's statements yesterday. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, there can be, you know, honest disagreements about what information means. And remember, also, the information flow is uneven. Not everybody commenting had access to the same level of classified information. So I'd probably restrain myself from suggesting anything's afoot other than John Brennan's demagoguery and, you know, the same from the rest of the Obama era apparatchiks. Bob in Waukegan, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, the fact that Andrew McCabe has to ask for immunity tells you probably everything you need to know about what's going on. If a senior law enforcement official from our government has to ask for immunity to tell the truth, we're in serious trouble. They look for Trump Russia collusion under every rock for 2 years. They haven't found a thing. The entire damn countryside of America is burning up because of the FBI and the CIA and the Obama administration's misuse of government departments. And the Democrats are just fine with our country. This is insane. They ought to lock every one of those damn people up and sort it out in the Congress and the Senate. And lock McCabe, Comey, Rosenstein, lock them all up, get the documents, find out who's guilty, and send them to jail.
Thanks for the call, Bob.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. We're talking about the DOJ IG report coming out on Comey and some other matters. Quickly, Chuck in the car, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, hi, Dan and Amy. The report's coming out. You know, Paul Ryan, I think I heard him say that the FBI can investigate the president, which is fine. They can investigate Hillary Clinton, too. How did that work out? It didn't work out too well. They couldn't even get the laptops from the Weissman Schultz, you know, for some reason. I don't know why they couldn't do that, but it's a deep state, evidently. And, you know, it just goes on and on. I mean, you parse words, you know, the factions of the Republicans and all the Democrats, you know, the any little thing that happens, they use that against the president. You know? But they don't look into the whole story. That's just my thought.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Chuck. That's why I just continue to say, let's just keep asking the right questions, demanding answers to the right questions, and that's a way to stay focused amid all of the hot air from both sides. Switching gears, you know, we exported a Chicago Democrat to the White House, and that didn't work out too well. Now we've exported a Chicago three-point specialist to Golden State, and he's really annoying.
You don't like Steve Kerr?
He's really starting to get annoying because he's becoming one of these virtue signaling people in athletics who, as we were talking with Steve Ashburner earlier this week,
yeah.
NBA.com, like, I'm not doing something important, really, in the grand scheme of things. So now I'm going to wade into areas I don't really know what I'm talking about because I need to feel important. I need to be part of, you know, the important, enlightened intelligentsia. And that's sort of what Steve Kerr is doing. Steve Kerr on the whole Philadelphia Eagles flap, which is relevant to Steve Kerr. Why?
Steve, there was that famous line famously attributed to Michael Jordan about, you know, Republicans buy shoes too? Like, how did you think it evolved to this point where guys are were willing to be outspoken?
I just think the world changed. You know, I think in the 90s we were living in sort of a blissfully ignorant state. I think there, you know, it was sort of pre-terrorism, pre-9/11, pre-social media. I think life was a lot simpler. And I think athletes recognize, and people in general recognize, that it's a much different time, and there's a lot of angst and a lot of things to be concerned about and things that need to be changed, whether it's, you know, violence, school shootings, police brutality. There's so many issues that stand out and that are critical, and I think people in general, not just athletes, feel the need to do something. And we now have the forum to do so. We have a much bigger platform to try to do good, and so I'm proud of all the people who do that.
Uh-huh. Oh, gosh, here we go. Athletes trying to do good in the policy realm. Kerr went on to say, sports are always a uniter. It's one of the beautiful parts of sports. You see what the Eagles did for the city of Philadelphia.
Name assassinator.
Man.
City assassinator.
And how happy everybody was. Sports brings people together. Mm-hmm. It just so happens now that we have an interesting time politically. We have a lot of athletes who aren't afraid to speak out. But no, sports have always been a great way to unite family, friends, communities, and everything else. Is that what the Eagles did? Everybody's happy together.
Now the new news this morning, you're rubbing off on me, is that one Philadelphia Eagle football player was going to go to the White House. That's why they
great.
Canceled it. Yeah.
And I like I think
they should have celebrated that one.
I think Tim from Woodstock said yesterday in a caller, Trump should have embraced the one, taken him to play golf, and had a grand old day, and just kind of put it right back on him.
It would have been perfect.
That would have been fun.
Mike, on
the north side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. These people have to learn, keep their mouth shut and dribble the basketball. It's time to boycott the NBA like the NFL. I mean, they're not getting paid for that. I don't want to hear their opinion, and it's going to cost them financially. If conservatives can be boycotted, so can liberals.
Yeah.
And I texted you about the Eagles a couple days ago. Who cares about the Eagles in the White House? Don Felder left the group and Glenn Frey died.
Zing.
No one cares.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Ba-dum-bump. I like it. I like when Steve Kerr or LeBron or Kevin Durant, they want to spout off. I like it.
Formed a solidarity. Steve Kerr and LeBron have already agreed that no matter who wins this playoff, which obviously the Warriors are going to win because they're up 3 games mm-hmm. to zero, mm-hmm. to nothing, that neither team is going to go to the White House. Well, guess what? The invite hasn't even gone out, and it's not going to go out now.
If the net result of this, we stop at the pro forma ceremonies to celebrate championship teams at the White House and bring them into the realm of politics, then all the better. But I always like when people hold forth with what they really think and convey to you who they really are. It's clarifying. We should embrace it.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
You want more than just the headlines? Find out what's going on and what it means with me, Dennis Prager, this morning at 11, right here on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Well, a much-anticipated new book from Jonah Goldberg, National Review. We've talked to him a number of times over the last several months, and he was working on it, and we were waiting patiently for it. And finally, it is here, Amy.
So long.
Yeah, that's right. So finally, it's here. You know, he likes to do that. He likes to
tease people.
Exactly. You know, make you want it more. His new book is Suicide of the West, How the Rebirth of Tribalism, Populism, Nationalism, and Identity Politics is Destroying American Democracy. Jonah Goldberg from National Review joins us now. Jonah, thanks for being with us again. Appreciate it.
It's great to be here. And look, I thought we all understood that in this day and age, it's all about the tease. It's all about,
yes.
you know,
yes.
stay tuned, you know, tune in this time next week to see what happens. Who gets kicked off, you know, Trump Island or whatever. And that's how life works.
Trump lured in Kim Jong-un. He broke up with him before he could break up with him. And now they're making amends.
There you go.
Yeah, and eventually he's going to give a flower to Kim.
So. You're such a showman, Jonah.
What to wear.
So Suicide of the West, How the Rebirth of tribalism, populism, nationalism, and identity politics. It's a lot of isms plus identity politics, destroying American democracy. A pickinism or identity politics, and make your or offer your thesis.
Sure. If you wanted to make it an inism, you can call it identitarianism, but I don't want to use that word, but that is the right word for it. So take identity politics, right? One of the most part of the argument of my book is that democracy, free speech, human rights, natural rights, property rights, the market, all of these things are essentially unnatural in the sense that for 250,000 years, human beings did not organize their lives around any of these institutions or concepts, and they did not appear until remarkably recently in the evolutionary record. And so one of the things I try to do in the book is point out how precious and brief this miracle we have of prosperity really is. For 250,000 years, the average human being everywhere in the world lived on $3 a day or less. And then once and only once in all of human history did that start to change. It started to change in England because of liberal democratic capitalism, the Enlightenment, whatever you want to call it. I call it the miracle. Radically transformed the way we thought about ourselves and the kind of civilization we wanted to live in. So take identity politics. One of the most amazing things the founding fathers did was get rid of titles of nobility. Throughout human history, all around the world, for the last 10,000 years, in every city-state, you know, sort of civilization, there was this notion that some people were just born better or more deserving than other people. And the founding fathers got rid of that. They junked it. Now, we still had slavery. We can talk about slavery in a second, and that was a terrible evil and hypocrisy. But this idea that we should all be recognized on merit was planted in American soil, and it's taken time to grow. The thing about identity politics is it's a very reactionary, sort of ancient way of looking at the world, which says, I can reduce an entire person's life to a single abstract category, be it race, a sexual preference, whatever. That sort of thinking isn't modern. It isn't woke. It's ancient. It is the way we used to categorize people from serfs and peasants to, you know, this tribe versus my tribe for tens of thousands of years. And it's making a comeback with a lot of fancy jargon around it. And we now live in this age where I can reduce all black people to a single historical grievance. I can reduce, you know, I know all I need to know about somebody because of the color of their skin. That's what identity politics does, and it needs to be rejected.
I just want to pick up on this. I mean, I definitely agree with all that, but I want to pick up on this idea of the miracle, as you call it. I read an excerpt from your book that you posted on National Review. You say, I say miracle because it evokes a glorious but inexplicable mystery, not because it was bequeathed by the Almighty. And you start the piece, too, talking about, you know, you're taking God out of the argument. And you just referenced the founders. And I wonder if you're concerned at all that you're promoting sort of self-deification, because one thing the Declaration of Independence and the Bible were both clear on is we can't deify ourselves.
Oh, look, it's a huge, huge part of my argument that that's exactly what we're doing, and it's a terrible thing. I put it under the label romanticism, which puts feelings and internal authenticity as the highest standards of things. You know, we teach kids today, Hollywood teaches everybody today, go with your guts, go with your feelings. The only person you have to worry about is being true to yourself. I think that's a terrible trend in our culture. I'm not an atheist. I'm not saying that God doesn't exist. And at the end of the book, you know, God basically sneaks back in, because I think one of the reasons we're in the mess we're in is we've lost this conception of being God-fearing, of worrying that even when I'm alone or even when no one else is watching, God is watching me. That's one of the things that made the miracle possible. The reason I say the first sentence of the book is there is no God in this book is simply to say that I'm not making an appeal to authority. I'm trying to persuade people who disagree with me. And if I say to a bunch of progressives, hey, we got the miracle, we got all the stuff because God gave it to us, that doesn't work on them. That certainly doesn't work on an atheist. An appeal to authority is a logical fallacy unless everybody agrees beforehand on the authority. And so what I'm trying to do is work with progressives' own terms and say, you say you claim to care about poverty, you claim to care about bigotry, you claim to care about, you know, public health, all of these things. Well, liberal democratic capitalism is the only thing in human history that has proven to fix those things, to improve those things. And we should have some gratitude for it. And the reason why I say there's no God in this book is we can't just simply, you know, say, let Jesus take the wheel. There is no right side of history here. As Ronald Reagan used to say, we're always just one generation away from tyranny because we do not inherit freedom in our blood. You have to fight for it and you have to teach it to every generation. And so the no God in this book thing. Yeah. I'm sorry, go on.
No, but you wrote too, before the miracle, human life was nasty, brutish, and short.
Yeah, the average, you know, people like to ask, why is there poverty? We know why there's poverty. Poverty is the natural human condition. As a species and as individuals, we're all born, you know, naked, penniless, and ignorant. The only interesting question is, why is there wealth? And there's only one answer in all of human history, and it's this bizarre miracle that we stumbled into that has caused human prosperity to skyrocket around the world in the span of six lifetimes, while it stayed basically flat and near zero for 7,500 lifetimes.
Right, and not to prompt you to do another Carrie Underwood reference, but just to go back to this for a second, I understand what you're trying to do with the jujitsu of using the progressives' own stated positions against them, kind of working their logic against them. But is it possible to be persuasive if there's no appeal to truth? Right. I mean, if you believe that the Bible is the foundation of truth and it's the foundation of our founding documents and thus the foundation of our country, Judeo-Christian religious tradition, then don't you at some point have to make the case about the choice that we all have to live the way of nature or the way of grace, as it were?
Yeah, at the end of the day, it's not going to be my job to go around proselytizing people certainly not to find Jesus, nor to become, you know, better Jews. That's not the role I'm trying to play. I'm trying to use the logic of the Enlightenment to explain to people on the right and the left that according to, you know, the bedrock, you know, the things that everyone says public discourse is supposed to be about, which is science and facts and reason and argument and persuasion, that there is no way to look at these facts, even if you don't have, you know, even for an atheist, there's no way to look at these facts and not say that this stuff is the only game in town. This is what pulled us out of the muck. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the reasons why we may be heading back into the muck, and I'm perfectly willing to concede this, is that we've lost as a civilization the binding glue that religion provides and the sense of self-denial and delayed gratification that comes with being religiously informed. I'm a big fan of religion. I'm a big fan of Christianity. You know, I like Catholicism so much I married one. I'm not trying to denigrate religion. What I am trying to do is just sort of bring people a little closer to where the facts are, regardless of appeals to religion.
Okay. I just wanted to get clarity on that. One other thing you referenced, too, is John Rawls, who's sort of the celebrated theorist of the left, is maybe the godfather of social justice, as it's kind of, maybe it's been bastardized in terms of what he was thinking, but I think there's references to him in terms of what people are actually doing in the modern context. And I wonder if what you're trying to do by evoking Rawls is take his original position, and that's another jujitsu play against the left. If you want to conceive, or if you want to kind of start from Rawls's original position argument, then now look at what you have done, the society you've created from this sort of foundational philosophy where you started.
Yeah, I mean, let me just sort of push back on one thing. You know, look, I've paid my dues in doing lots of, liberal tears are delicious kind of argumentation. And that's not what I'm trying to do in this book. You said a couple of times now, jujitsu against the left and all that kind of stuff. I'm not trying to beat up the left here. I'm actually trying to model behavior that I think is really lacking on the right these days and actually try to persuade people who disagree with me in good faith. And I make all sorts of concessions to the left. I don't write anything I don't believe to be true in the book, but I make all sorts of concessions to the left in an effort of good faith to sort of try and persuade people, which is one of the reasons why I find some of the left-wing reviews of this book, their hostility and bad faith, really kind of astounding. On the question about Rawls, yeah, that's part of the argument. I mean, part of the argument is if you were a visitor from outer space and you looked at the way human beings behaved and you had to go live amongst us, you would be a fool if you didn't pick sometime in the last 50 years. You know, the Rawls argument, as you clearly know, is that imagine you were in some limbo where all you knew is you're going to be born in some place and some time on Earth, but you didn't know if you're going to be poor or rich, black or white,
right,
gay or straight, or any of those kinds of things. What time on Earth would you pick and what place? And you would pick somewhere in Western Europe or the United States basically in the last 20 years because you're just playing the odds about who you're going to be. Now, my problem, just for the sake of, I mean, it's a little unrelated, but my problem with Rawls, or one of my problems with Rawls, is that his argument completely falls apart, or his moral authority completely falls apart on the issue of abortion. Because, you know, the one thing, if you were in that limbo, trying to figure out where you were going to be born, the one thing that you would want to guarantee before anything else was that you'd be born at all.
Yes. Yes, that, yeah, exactly. So just on the book, though, since clarify that for me. So one of the things you're doing then is you're just taking people as at face value. You're not sort of assessing motives. You're just assessing positions and saying, well, if this is what you want, then, you know, look at the tracks that can be pursued to get there and which seems to be more fruitful.
Yeah, I mean, look, there are times when I talk about motives because a big chunk of the book has to do with, you know, evolutionary science and human nature and why we do what we do. But it's not a sort of partisan left-right kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, part of my problem is with the tribalism, and, you know, on the right, and I don't like populism and all that stuff either. But, you know, at the core, you know, look, Hannah Arendt used to say that every generation, Western civilization, is invaded by barbarians. We call them children. And anybody who's had kids knows that kids come with a bunch of preloaded software, right? They have a bunch of instincts and responses. There's a wonderful book by a guy named Paul Bloom called Just Babies, just summarizing all of the research that they do on the preloaded moral software that babies have. You know, babies cry in distinct national accents. Is always fascinating stuff, and my point is that we come into that we are born not into the United States or Western civilization. We're born into families, and the barbarians that are born into our families, they need software updates. And you hear people say all the time, "Oh, you have to be taught to hate." That's just factually untrue. You have to teach people. You have to teach people not to hate. We all come wired with a deep distrust of strangers because that's how we evolved, or that's how the evolutionary science says we evolved. Because if you didn't, you know, strangers were the enemy. The tribe was everything. The tribe was us, was my family, my politics, my religion, my entertainment, my faith, was everything. And everything outside of the tribe was to be distrusted. The beautiful thing about the market is that it lowers the barrier to interaction with strangers. In a state of nature, if you're carrying a bushel of apples and I want your apples, I hit you over the head with a rock and take your apples. In a market, I give you money. You like money. I like apples. It's win-win.
No, I think that's really well said. It's very interesting. The part about where you're talking about kind of the concerns about the right. You mentioned nationalism. Nationalism is a part of the isms that are in the title of the book. And I wonder what exactly you mean kind of the current incarnation of nationalism that troubles you? This is sort of jingoism, or what you're referencing specifically?
Yeah, so, you know, this is an argument I have. It's a good faith argument with several of my colleagues, including Rich Lowry, the editor of National Review, who's not only a handsome man, but he's a powerful man. But my view about nationalism is it's, you know, look, all poisons, all of them, are measured in the dose, right? And so a little nationalism, I think, is healthy. It's sort of like salt, right? A pinch of salt brings out the flavor in the meal, brings all the dishes, all the ingredients together. A little too much salt can ruin the meal. A way too much salt can literally kill you. And so my problem with nationalism is partly just the problem of degree. I prefer the language of patriotism to the language of nationalism. Nationalism invariably lends itself to a lot of us versus them thinking. It lends itself often, though not necessarily, but often to a kind of ethno-nationalism, which I think is contrary to what this country was always about. My ultimate problem with nationalism is that invariably, if you think, you know, that our politics has to be about the expression of nationalist sentiment, that is almost always going to mean centralization and empowering the government in Washington, because the government in Washington is the only institution in the entire country that has any claim to speak for the whole country. And so nationalism historically is deeply, deeply, you know, Marxists want to tell you that it's that nationalism and socialism are opposites, but historically in every country that goes hardcore nationalist, it becomes hardcore socialist. Every country that becomes hardcore socialist becomes hardcore nationalist, because the two words in economics and in politics are essentially interchangeable.
Yeah, and that references another great book you wrote, Liberal Fascism. He is Jonah Goldberg. He's joining us with his canine studio audience. National Review columnist, author of the book Suicide of the West, How the Rebirth of Tribalism, Populism, Nationalism, and Identity Politics is Destroying America. Suicide of the West. Pick it up. Jonah, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
It was a real pleasure. Thank you.
And he joined us on our Turnkey Debt Pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We've got a lot of things to talk about with our colleague Mike Gallagher. Leaked characterization of the forthcoming DOJ IG report on Comey and Lynch, what Paul Ryan had to say about Spygate. So many things. The details of Obama administration lying about the Iran deal. Important geopolitical things that negatively or positively impact the future of Western civilization, Amy.
Yes.
But that's not what I want to talk about, Mike Gallagher.
What do you want to talk to about? The pardoning of Alice Johnson?
The Tony Awards, obviously.
Oh, the Tony
Awards.
We're
talking Mr. Broadway, Mike Gallagher.
Oh, yes.
Joins us now, Mike Gallagher, host of The Mike Gallagher Show, weekdays 9 to 11 on these airwaves. Mike, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
And Dan, ever the very prescient host that you are, I'm right in the middle of a run of one of the greatest American musicals ever made, Guys and Dolls.
Sure.
I'm playing Nicely, Nicely Johnson. I open tomorrow night. And theater geek that I am, you know, some people have baseball cards or they collect stamps.
Right.
I just like theater a lot, and I live in Manhattan, and so I go to theater all the time, and it's just a big deal for me. So the crisis now is how to do a performance on Sunday and make it to the Tony Awards to watch the Tony Awards Sunday night. So while normal people are with their families and breaking bread and watching, you know, ball games and stuff, I'm going to be geeking out in front of the hotel, you know, TV set watching the Tony Awards. That's how shallow and petty and pathetic.
Well, no,
everyone has their downtown problems. Everybody has a hobby. Well, what's your favorite musical?
Well, just before Guys and Dolls, I mean, I see you as a big Julie.
Well, I'm nicely Johnson, which is a great role because you know, there's no costume changes. Nicely, nicely gets to sing the big 11 o'clock number, sit down, you're rocking the boat, without having the pressure of the show, like as one of the main leads. But no, and I did this role like 25 years ago, so now I guess I'm more age appropriate. I don't need a fat suit like I did when I was a kid.
Because
nicely's would, always.
It's just like Val Kilmer coming back to do Top Gun.
Thank you. Or for theater freaks, Yul Brynner coming back to play the king in King and I. You know, now I'm kind of really middle aged and fat.
Can you give us a few bars, or is that a SAG-AFTRA violation?
Well, it's an equity, actors' equity rule that I can't sing before noon. Oh, plus, boy. I'm kind of tired. But I mean, no, this is Tech Week, so this is when it all. But it really, all kidding aside, it's a pretty cool opportunity. The theater is in Dallas. They have about a 35-piece orchestra. Huge sets, huge production, big cast, professional theater, lots of professional actors from New York who are actually in Dallas doing this show, and I'm pretty excited to open up tomorrow night, guys, but not quite as excited as the news that I get to visit with my my top morning show, Dan and Amy, this morning.
You're a multifaceted performer, just like
honestly,
Amy.
Honestly, I thought you guys were joking around.
No.
This is the real deal. So you've played this role before, you don't really have to study your lines, or are they etched in your brain?
No, you really do. I mean, it's not quite like falling off a bike. I mean, it's been 25 years since I played this role, but it's not as hard as other roles I played. A couple years ago, I played Max Bialystock in a production of The Producers.
Yeah.
That's the hardest role I've ever played. Tough songs, and you know, the Nathan Lane role that just goes on and on, and the Zero Mostel created it in the movie, but it's a terrific musical. But it's kind of my passion, and I haven't acted in a few years, and they called me and said, hey, you want to come to Dallas for about a month and a half and do Nicely and Guys and Dolls? And so tomorrow night's opening night, and I'm pumped. I'm ready to go.
Well, you're still going to do your radio show, right?
Radio show every morning and then theater at night.
Well,
and
Dan, I'm sorry, and I'd love to see you in the leg warmers and the tights too, by the way.
No, you don't. You don't want to see that, but I am glad you started to say the three words that you must say to
break
an actor.
Leg.
Yeah, do not say the other thing. GL is not.
No.
That's bad luck to say the first thing.
I have no musical ability or acting ability, talent really, generally speaking, but I am a patron of the theater, so I know this.
We
need to get Mike in town, maybe bring Chicago back here. You could play Billy Flynn.
Ooh, Billy Flynn's a great role. You know what I've done around the country once in a while? My dear friend, family friend, Sally Struthers and I have performed the play Love Letters by A.R. Gurney. It's a very touching, poignant play. It's a two-person play, and we've done that as a benefit for my foundation, Gallagher's Army, the Fallen Officer Fund, which helps the families of police officers killed in the line of duty. We've done that in a number of cities around the country. So maybe one of these days, Sally and I will have to come to town and do Love Letters. It'll be a lot of fun. Have you guys be our special VIP guests.
Does she ever slip and call you Meathead?
No, she does, and I don't think it's slipping. I think she means it. She's quite a character. She's just as good. She's just as crazy as you think she is.
All right.
I've learned so much about you this morning. In the next 7 minutes.
The layers to Mike Gallagher. The layers. All right. Well, we got to talk a little political news too, Paul Ryan, the D.C. press corps yesterday was in full froth over the notion that Paul Ryan undermined President Trump's assertions about Spygate. And I didn't really interpret it that way. I interpreted it as here's what I believe to be true at this point, but we still have questions to be answered. We still have a briefing next week. I thought it was rather measured. What was your take?
Dan, I have the same reaction you do. There's an over-the-top disdain that a lot of people seem to have for Paul Ryan, and it's almost like there's this sort of need to make him the boogeyman. And frankly, I don't know that he is. I mean, I wish he was had been a little bit more assertive in his defense of the president and the agenda, but I don't see him as this guy who's this devious, you know, malcontent who's trying to do harm. I know last night on Lou Dobbs' show, and Lou's a friend of mine, but Lou was like, get him the heck out of there. He needs to go. He's a joke. He's terrible. He's a disaster and ought to quit right this minute. And there are plenty of listeners who feel that way. I think the same way. I feel the same way you do. There was he's a very measured guy, maybe not as charismatic or as in your face as red meat Republicans would like. But I had the same takeaway you did. What's fascinating to me is that you mentioned this IG report, and of course it was supposed to be out in May. Guys, do you remember how to connect? Remember what Trump said when Comey was first fired, and everybody was scratching their heads saying, "Wait a minute, he's fired because of the way he handled the Hillary email investigation," and everybody kind of shrugged their shoulders, and we moved on from that, and that was the Trump administration's position. Well, here we go with all multiple sources reporting that this IG report from Horowitz is expected to blast Comey as being having been insubordinate, and blasting Loretta Lynch and blasting a number of these top Justice Department officials as not done their job. Well, rewind. Remember, that's what Trump said a long time ago, and we forget that. How many times have we seen things come to fruition that have been tweeted about by this unpredictable president, you know, this bull in a china shop, as I call him? He is often more right than wrong, but we forget it because we have such a fire hose of information and news coming at us that the cycle changes every 24 hours, you know, veering from Samantha Bee into something else, and we forget, oh, he was right all along. So I think it's worth noting, next week, a huge week with the North Korea summit. This is something that was unthinkable during the Obama administration. And, you know, we'll sit back and watch the media and not give him credit where credit is due. There are extraordinary accomplishments being achieved in this first year and a half or so. And I believe more and more Americans are standing up and paying notice.
Yeah, I do think President Trump was spot on with Comey's, you know, insubordination. It's highly concerning and pretty rare. But what about Spygate? What about the Russians or the FBI alleged spy or source that was implemented into Trump's campaign? Because Paul Ryan and Trey Gowdy seem to be on the same page that the FBI did the right thing.
Yeah, I mean, and again, this is when you talk about layers of people. There are layers of intrigue to all of this. When Ryan says that Gowdy was accurate when he said the FBI had acted appropriately, I happen to have a lot of confidence in Trey Gowdy. Again, he's been identified and sort of tarred and feathered as more recently as a swamp creature by red meat Republicans, and I get it. I get the frustration. I get the impatience. But frankly, and they are at odds with the president, who has claimed that there was a spy embedded in the campaign. But listen, this is all being unwound. It's taking longer than we hoped. It's a distraction. It's unnecessary. There are solid, important things that people care about. I don't believe, I mean, we're into it because we're in the weeds with all this stuff, guys, but I don't believe that Americans who are trying to put food on their table and pay the mortgage give a rat's rear end about Spygate or about the IG report or about Comey. You know, they want to know what the economy is going to do and if they're going to be able to hold on to their job or maybe get a raise. They want to know if there's going to be border security. They want to know if, you know, Kim Jong-un is going to send off missiles. Those are things that matter, and those are things that the president is attempting to address. I just hope all these distractions don't pull him into a different direction from where he ought to be.
What's your assessment of his use of his pardon power over the last couple of weeks, including yesterday commuting the sentence of one Alice Johnson?
This seems to be a great example of a non-politician who suddenly is the leader of the free world. You know, I mean, he doesn't do anything the way it's, and I put this in quotes, supposed to be done. This story of this most recent commutation, this lady, and the things she said about President Trump, I mean, this just has to fly in the face of the haters when they ask her, what do you think of this president? I love this man. No one listened to us. I mean, you know, for such a so-called bigoted racist president, here's a guy who posthumously, pardoned the Great White Hope, the black, the black box. Boxer. Family asked the Obama administration, please, can you please clear our loved one's record? And the Obama administration's position was pretty much, we don't pardon dead people. Well, you know, Trump knew how important this was to his family. And so you see these people of color and minorities and people who have been ignored in the past being addressed and assisted by this president. Again, wow, what a wacky thing for a for a bigoted, racist, you know, hate monger like Donald Trump to do. It's pretty extraordinary. We're living in extraordinary times, Dan and Amy, and I just always wonder if we're able to appreciate the history that we're experiencing day by day.
And maybe more African Americans will look at the Republican Party now and take a second look at President Trump.
It's a great point. I mean, look at unemployment right now in the black community is the lowest it's been since they've been keeping the record books on it. Now, I'm sorry, that's not a coincidence that these economic policies have led to that. And so, I think a lot of African-Americans are saying, you know what, maybe this guy isn't so bad. Maybe this guy's great for America, and we're gonna give the Republican Party, which came up with these tax cuts and this great tax law, another look.
He is Mike Gallagher. You mainly know him from Broadway productions like Guys and Dolls. He also has a radio show, The Mike Gallagher Show, weekdays 9 to 11 on these airwaves right after us. Mike, thanks for joining
us. Great visiting with you. Thanks for having me, guys. Keep fighting the good fight. Take care.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
No victocrats allowed. Why? Because we've got a country to save. Join me, Larry Elder, tonight starting at 7 on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. 300 women in Springfield who work in and around state government signed a letter last year decrying the culture of sexual harassment and abuse inside and around state government. At that time, only one woman who had come forward, Denise Rothheimer, we've had on the show. Her allegations and the ultimate finding of fault with respect to State Senator Ira Silverstein, cost him his seat. He lost the primary election. Now you've had three more women come forward. Elena Hampton, a former Madigan staffer, making allegations of harassment by one of Madigan's field goons. You had a woman come forward, an advocate, and accuse Madigan's deputy majority leader, Lou Lang, of inappropriate behavior.
Yeah, she was on our show.
Mm-hmm. Marianne Lancour. You've had Kelly Cassidy, who's a state rep in the Democrat caucus, talk of her mistreatment. You've had another state rep, Deb Conroy, in the caucus last year. She didn't want to go against Madigan. She didn't want to say anything negative about Madigan. She didn't want to say anything at all about it. But she was also harassed by the same person, allegedly, that harassed Elena Hampton.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there seems to be a
Or one of the two that was pegged at the time. And now you've got this Sherry Garrett.
Right. There seems to be a locker room environment going on down there in Springfield. Sherry Garrett coming forward yesterday is talking about multiple instances of being bullied and harassment.
Over the course of the last several years, I have endured and have personally witnessed bullying and repeated harassment that was often sexual and sexist in nature in my workplace. In my case, this harassment has taken place at the highest levels in the State House. Tim Mapes, Chief of Staff to Speaker Madigan, has made repeated inappropriate comments to me and around me, both in the office and on the House floor.
So Tim Mapes, Madigan's implementation guy for a long time, he then hastily resigns. I mean, the speed of this was really interesting because to me it indicates Madigan is in full self-survival mode. She has a press conference at 11 a.m. yesterday, makes the charges, names Mapes, Madigan's chief of staff. By early afternoon, Mapes resigned, Madigan putting out a press release that Mapes resigned at his
But from everything. I mean, he also resigned as the executive director of the Democratic Party of Illinois. But what he did to Sherry Garrett allegedly is made really lewd, inappropriate comments.
Tim Mapes said, completely out of nowhere, that I needed to make sure that I was not showing my pink bra to the judge during Inauguration Day because he knows how the girls who work on the second floor like to leave little to the imagination.
And the point of contention is that when women felt harassed or bullied, they had to go through Tim Mapes to get to Mike Madigan.
The only way as an employee to see Speaker Madigan is you have to make an appointment through Tim.
The interesting thing is that you've got the inner sanctum of Madigan that has been pierced. And so the question is, one of the questions, all of the virtue signaling Me Too types that you know rallied to pass the Equal Rights Amendment 400 years after its introduction.
Well, 36, but okay.
this past session,
yeah.
Because they're you know because they're such proponents of women.
Uh-huh.
Oh, where are they now? Jeannie Ives, a proponent of women from a different direction, a Republican, of course, had this to say.
The Democrats have a real problem in this culture of sexual harassment, and it's not going to get changed with Speaker Madigan in charge.
For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by Kristen McQuarrie, she of the Chicago Tribune editorial board. Kristen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Editorial in the Chicago Tribune. When will Democrat members, especially those who make a public show of their opposition to harassment, grow a spine? They're all about hashtag Me Too when it's trendy, just not when it actually matters. Is there any indication, Kristen, that spines are growing in the wake of the MAPES resignation?
I mean, not yet, but as you mentioned, you can't get any closer to Madigan than Tim Mapes. This is someone who's been his chief of staff since the early 90s. Everything goes through Tim Mapes. On those days when session is really busy, he's the person setting up the committee rooms. He's the person deciding who's going to sit on the committees. He's subbing people out. He's providing staff. He decides if you get an attorney to help with your petitions when it's time to run. He decides what bills get assigned to you. So this is kind of Speaker Madigan's gatekeeper, hatchet man. The fact that he's gone, I think, will kind of settle a lot of that uprising. But this is as close as it gets to hitting the speaker directly.
But there's, she complained of multiple instances of bullying and harassment, but this isn't really sexual abuse or sexual assault.
Not at all. And I think the issue with Tim Mapes is not going to rest on sexual harassment. Yes, he made these comments, which were highly inappropriate. And he made them, by the way, during all of this. One of the accusers' claims is happened as recently as a couple of months ago when they were all having to go through sexual harassment training, and Tim Mapes was kind of belittling it and mocking it and joking around to some of the male members, had they gone to their sex training yet today? So this is all very recent. But no, I think the bigger issue with him, because I think male staffers and lawmakers would come forward too, that he runs a very tight ship, and that's putting it nicely. That whole label that you attach to Madigan, how disciplined he is, that's because of someone like Tim Mapes. And just the stories I've heard over the years from lawmakers, male and female, about how he doles out punishment. I mean, you mentioned Kelly Cassidy earlier, Northside lawmaker. Tim Mapes made a phone call to her boss. She was doing some part-time work for Tom Dart, just to inquire about her employment status. That was a signal because she was starting to get out of line. And those are the types of things that he's done over the years. I've heard lawmakers who didn't behave as they were supposed to be. They got their seats moved in the House chamber. They didn't get attorneys to help them gather petitions. Just a lot of these backdoor channels of keeping people in their places. And I just want to mention one more thing. The Tribune years ago did a story trying to connect how many people in government got their jobs through Mike Madigan / Tim Mapes. And they were able to track it to 400 people and positions.
What?
That's just how many they were able to track.
There's exponentially more than that. I mean, it's in the thousands, maybe tens of thousands. I mean, over 40 years, 400, that's nothing. But I understand what you're saying, which is what you could substantiate. Here's the thing. I mean, the Kelly Cassidy thing, notwithstanding the propriety of a state rep being an employee of the sheriff's office or these state legislators that are employees of or lobbyists for other governmental units, the inherent conflict of that. The question is the combination of the progressive caucus within the Chicago Democrat Party. I mean, I guess that's what it is. That's the power structure. I mean, I guess that's increasingly the whole party as they move left, just as what's happening at the national level, the hard move left. Is there any sense that there is an uprising against Madigan with Mapes out of the way, that now he's actually weaker and this is the chance to make the move? Maybe the hard leftists like Kelly Cassidy and Ghisardi and some of the other ones, combined with the J.B. Pritzker, who doesn't need to have Madigan to worry about as he's running for governor.
It's certainly possible, but the reason I raised those 400 positions is because those are family members of a lot of these lawmakers. And so Madigan is still, he's not going to let go of that grip of power, and he still does have influence over these members. And just think about what Madigan has survived. He was very close to Joe Berrios. He has escaped any scrutiny for the most part over the whole scandal with how the property tax system works.
Yeah.
He was part of a federal investigation in the early 2000s, handing out bonuses to state workers that federal investigators in Central Illinois were looking at. He survived the patronage scandal at Metra just a couple of years ago. He has survived the clout scholarships, giving scholarships to U of I and other.
Yeah, but this is different. This is different because it's everybody gets this, and it's a national national zeitgeist behind it. This is not some.
Well,
kind
the Me Too movement has taken down more powerful men than Mike Madigan.
Well, but like comparing this to like a Metra patronage scandal, that's so inside baseball in a city in a state that's inured to corruption. This is something different, don't you think?
I mean, I guess if I were seeing some sort of reaction from these lawmakers that you mentioned, I've been calling them out on Twitter, just reminding them that they were all part of the Me Too march. They mm-hmm. marched in the streets. They wear the pink hats. They all wore black during Rauner's State of the State address in January as a sign of solidarity. And they're not saying anything. I haven't even seen like a press release except for maybe one of them. So that's why I'm not feeling that they're going to go after Madigan. I think removing Tim Mapes kind of removes the cancer, and they will be satisfied with that.
Everybody's pretty jumpy, though. I mean, former Governor Rauner, he called for Ken Duncan's resignation from the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District Board yesterday, because Ken Duncan was one of the legislators that was named by Sherry Garrett as having been inappropriate with her. Which is
because he was naughty with her. No, he allegedly asked two ladies who would be the naughtiest if they went back to his house. I mean, it's disgusting.
Yeah, well, that's and it's not surprising either, unfortunately. But Duncan was recently appointed to MWRD by Rauner, which is a payback from that vote against stripping the governor of his collective bargaining powers. And he calls on Duncan to resign just weeks after he appointed him. So everybody's pretty jumpy about this.
They absolutely are. I mean, that was just a joke. I mean, he got the appointment through Rauner. He has no experience on MWRD. This is one of those just really cushy jobs that can get. It's an $80,000 salary. They meet once a month. So just the hypocrisy of that alone is borderline comical. But yeah, everybody is jumpy. And I think J.B. Pritzker coming out, and he was the first one yesterday to really step forward and say Tim Mapes needs to resign. And of course, he's the same guy who, during the primary, wouldn't say one bad word about Joe Berrios or Mike Madigan. But now that he's the nominee, suddenly he has a spine. And frankly, he doesn't need Mike Madigan anymore. He is kind of coasting through this campaign. He's not fearful of this organization anymore. So, yes, everyone's very jumpy.
Now, coasting through this campaign, you tweeted out, because there was other development yesterday that didn't receive as much attention because of all the MAPE stuff going on. But State Senator Karen McConaughey from Kane County announced that she is not seeking reelection. And you tweeted out something that she said she's looking for other opportunities. You talked about perhaps there being something, quote unquote, big in the works for McConaughey. Would you care to elaborate on that?
Well, this is just rumor, okay? This is just rumor, so please take it as that. But I have heard over the past couple of months that Governor Rauner is very discouraged. He and his wife do not want to write big checks anymore. They're tired of self-funding this campaign. He sees the numbers. He's worried he can't win. And there were some discussions about replacing him on the ticket. I know it sounds totally bizarre, and that's why I'm couching this as just rumor. But one of the names was Karen McConaughey, and it just struck me as an unusual time for her to be stepping down. She's kind of been a rising star in the legislature during all this Me Too because she heads up the Ethics Commission. And so maybe she's just going to scoot over to like some sort of internal job in the General Assembly. That's possible. Maybe she's going to go to the private sector. But her name did come up as someone who could be sort of a standby if Rauner decided he was going to get out of the race. I don't think
that's already talked about Todd Ricketts being offered that position.
Well, yes,
allegedly.
Exactly.
Another
no,
rumor.
It's really not a rumor, Dan.
Well,
there was money talked and how much money he'd be paid and given his campaign if he took the reins from Governor Rauner.
Well, it's just worth noting because these rumors, we're here in the first week of June and these rumors still persist. You're 5 months from the election.
Yes, and I mean, just watching Rauner's campaign, he really just seems not even be trying. Mm-hmm. And so that just kind of feeds more of the speculation that maybe he's going to give up and that he's willing to give up the seat because he knows that he can't win and he'd rather see a Republican take another shot at it. Now, I've heard other people say it would never happen. His ego is way too big to do something like that. But it's early, and yet it's not. And I just don't see a lot of enthusiasm on his side. You got to start campaigning, and I'm not seeing it.
And he's a businessman. I mean, pretty savvy businessman. Why is he going to want to throw away millions of dollars if he knows he's going to lose?
Exactly, especially when JB came out and said he's going to match, he's going to double down. For every dollar Rauner spends, he's going to spend two.
Oh, my gosh.
We've got to ask you about this report in the Chicago Tribune earlier this week. I mean, blockbuster report about the incidents of sexual abuse, assault, improper conduct by teachers and school administrators in CPS over the last, I think the period they looked at actual cases was from 2011 to present. And speaking of reckonings, what about the reckoning for ROM, for the city council, for the bureaucracy at CPS in the wake of that report?
I mean, that is just so shocking and abysmal. The buck does stop with Rom. And I think he gets away too often. He's done a really good job of separating himself from what happens at CPS, just messaging wise. He doesn't even really get asked about it a lot by the media. A couple of months ago, the state took over all the special education components of CPS because they were dropping the ball. So all the time with special ed, he really didn't get asked about that. But this is one of those issues where the buck does stop with him. And that story posted, I think, early on Friday or late Thursday. And it still took 3 or 4 days for him to come out and acknowledge responsibility. But it's big. I mean, this is going to give his opponents a lot of ammunition in the mayor's race.
All right. She is Krista McQuarrie, Chicago Tribune columnist and editorial board member, who will be sitting in for you tomorrow, Amy, when you're off doing your Day of Beauty or whatever you're doing.
Yeah, a Day of Beauty. Yes, I'm going to a wedding.
All right. Kristen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you to Phil, Amy. I look forward to it.
Yes, bring food for the crew.
Exactly.
Okay, I will.
Or may I suggest Uber Eats from McDonald's?
Bring food or cash, one of the two. Thanks, Kristen.
Oh, my goodness. Bye-bye.
And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, good morning. And some breaking news. The U.S. has reached a deal with the Chinese company ZTE, that telecom company, over which the president and his team have been negotiating with the Chinese for both in terms of the punishment for their pirating of American technology, their theft, as well as
business with Iranians and things that were frowned upon.
Like stealing our stuff?
Yeah, that too.
Stealing the stuff of
just
American companies.
Just don't touch my stuff, really.
The IP and whatnot. So that was being discussed in connection with the idea that perhaps we could get the Chinese to buy more U.S. products to deal with that trade imbalance that Trump worries about so much. There was some talk of $40 billion more annual purchases of U.S. goods by the Chinese. In the announcement, there's no indication of the quo with the quid, but ZTE will pay $1 billion and $400 million in escrow for future theft they plan to commit, And that's in addition to almost $900 million in penalties ZTE has already paid for their violations. So I don't know if it's hard to say if that's progress in this back and forth with the Chinese over trade policy and tariffs or not. But that deal that had been reported off and on for the last couple of weeks has now been consummated. And then this story yesterday that was underreported, a Senate subcommittee report on the Iranian nuclear deal that found that the Obama administration lied to Congress and lied to the American people and tried to get U.S. banks to break the law. But other than that, they were forthright and transparent.
There's nothing to see here, folks. Move along.
The administration, the Obama administration, was clear that Iran would not be given access to the U.S. financial system. That's what Jack Lew, the Treasury Secretary, and other Obama apparatchiks said. That's what they said. Then, February 24th, 2016, according to the Senate report, the Treasury Department issued a license permitting Iran to commit $5.7 billion it held in Oman to raise to U.S. dollars and then into euros. That would have violated the sanctions law as well as the terms of the Iran nuclear deal. As the Weekly Standards editorial puts it, to put it plainly, Obama officials asked U.S. banks to break the law and the banks said no. Huh. For more on these topics and others, we're pleased to be joined by Noah Rothman from Commentary Magazine, where he is the associate editor. Noah, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
What about that report on the Iranian nuclear deal, given the hysterics that the left was thrown into when Trump walked away from it recently?
Yeah, I mean, you remember hearing about how the Obama administration faced no scandals. It was a scandal-free administration.
Scandal-free.
Everyone, including the president, has suggested that they were just a forthright, up-and-up, above-board organization that didn't transgress any norms and certainly didn't break any laws. Well, there you go. I mean, this is just one of many, obviously, that was nonsense from the get-go, but this is an affirmation of what critics of the Iran deal have always said, that it was not a transparent process, that it was riddled with side deals. The IAEA had side deals, Europe had side deals, and now apparently the Obama administration was organizing an effort to enhance and strengthen the Iranian economy in violation of sanctions laws in order to sweeten the pot for Iran. This is the backdrop against which Donald Trump is heading to Singapore to negotiate a very fraught and complex agreement with the North Koreans designed ostensibly to denuclearize the peninsula. That is not going to happen. North Korea will not denuclearize. Are we going to give up? So what are we going to give up in that process? Because there's always going to be a lot on the table that we have to surrender as leverage in order to get illusory concessions on disarmament. Is a very disturbing prospect, and people who are very afraid of symmetry for these reasons, because it has a habit of sprawling and ending up putting the balance in favor of the rogue regimes, have a lot to point to as precedent.
Are you concerned then that this summit is happening at all? Would your advice and counsel be that the president does not engage with Kim Jong-un?
Yeah, I said he was correct to walk away from the summit when he said he walked away from it, and then everybody pretended like he never made that statement in the first place, the president included. And it was extremely bizarre, and I said they were wrong to do that. This is a process that should be limited to lower levels, functionaries, diplomats at a level that you can move up from. You know, once you have a principal summit, there's nowhere to go from there.
Right.
If it's a failure, then the lower-level diplomatic contacts are mooted. And which is why, by the way, the summit will not be a failure, air quotes. Something will emerge from that summit. There will be a, quote, success that emerges from that summit, and that scares me to death.
Well, what we do is we pay our enemies to be our friends, don't we? I mean, is that a possibility that we're going to, you know, lessen the sanctions on them and possibly help their oppressed people?
Yeah, sure. We will probably surrender security guarantees, perhaps diplomatic recognition, an end to the 1953 armistice. There will absolutely be economic assistance in the form of, as you said, reduced sanctions or something perhaps a little more substantial. I don't know. But we will be surrendering something, and North Korea will play ball. They have no choice but to pretend as though, to act as though they are participating in this process, just as Iran did. And everybody who's invested in diplomatic processes will say that Iran is compliant with whatever the lenient terms of the deal are, or rather North Korea is compliant with the lenient terms of the deal are. Again, this is all precedent. We watched this all happen with Iran. It was all an illusion, the appearance of success. And if anybody's really interested in peace on the peninsula, the summit seems to me to be a much more dangerous prospect than a hopeful one.
Well, I want to mainly know what Dennis Rodman gets out of it. Speaking of principles at the table.
Yeah, well, he's inserted himself, and he's going to be, you know, lurking around Singapore while they're having this summit.
That really adds a
reality TV touch flair to it.
Well, it adds its real intellectual heft and sobriety to this summit. All right, on to other serious things. Noah, you wrote a piece for commentary about the crisis that we are pretending to ignore. You're talking about the entitlement state and sort of the state of affairs with the big ticket welfare state systems in terms of their financial stability.
Yeah, it's no secret that, and we managed to push it off with Band-Aids. But we got some bad news over the course of this week. Apparently, according to the trustees for both programs, Medicare is going to go broke a lot faster than we thought it was going to. It's going to hit insolvency in 2026 instead of 2029. That's 8 years away for anybody who wants to do the math. In other words, the next president's either second term or first term. And the Social Security, quote-unquote, trust fund, which doesn't really exist, was tapped into by the program. This is going to be tapped into the program this week because it's going to reach the point at which it can no longer meet its obligations to its beneficiaries. Now, people who want to say that this is no big deal, e.g. Democrats who insist that both Medicare and Social Security can be expanded to the broader population without any sort of concern for the solvency of the programs, say that this isn't a really big thing, is that it's only going to hit a wall for certain aspects of the program, and certain beneficiaries may not get 100% of their benefits. They're only going to be able to pay out 90% of their benefits. No big deal. That's nonsense. If you even the smallest debate over the prospect of, say, for example, means testing Social Security beneficiaries results in garment rending, hair pulling out, insanity over the people who will be left in the streets to die. There's going to be a panic in the next decade. And also because, according to the CBO, in 2028, the nation's debt, sovereign debt, reaches over 100% of its GDP, at which point debt becomes inserviceable. Mm. We have a crisis. So we're either going to have a debate over serious cuts to the entitlement programs or really serious tax increases.
So
and
people
that's
that are
going to come amid and eventually the business cycle returns, right? I mean, we are due for a recession. So when this thing hits, it could hit amid some really serious political dysfunction.
I know how to fix it. Make it bigger. That's how you do.
Yeah. So people who are banking on their Social Security as their retirement plan, they should get another plan.
Well, I mean, everybody should have a 401k or some sort of a financial plan and put some money in something. I mean, it's a lot easier said than done. I know I can't do it, but it's something that, you know, you should be doing. It's not as though these benefits are going to disappear. Again, there's a difference between disability and retirement benefits, and people want to combine them all. But the bottom line is that you're going to have to engage in some kind of reform of these programs, not just Band-Aids. The president submitted some actually very good proposals, I thought. But it requires legislative action, and now is the time to do it. When the economy is healthy, when the jobless rate is under 4%, this is the time when the economy can absorb that kind of pain. It's not going to be the case forever, and when the business cycle returns, no one's going to want to be tightening belts, and that's the sort of thing we have to think about.
With those reviews of threats internal and external, we were joined by Noah Rothman, Associate Editor for Commentary Magazine. You can check out his most recent column talking about the entitlements and their financial state, the crisis we pretended to ignore. Noah, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy.
I'm feeling very guilty about Val Kilmer because he has slimmed down a lot, and he looks great, and he'll be the best Iceman in
Because he had throat cancer.
Well, yeah. He had throat cancer.
Yeah, no,
a lot of weight. Yeah. And
hey, we can still make fun of him for plumping up before he got throat cancer. That's fair game.
Well, he looked like Jeff Bridges for a while, and then...
It looks like he ate Jeff Bridges for a while.
Stop. And also, too, Danger Zone, Kenny Loggins is coming out with a new version of Danger Zone. Remember this song?
Yeah, no, I don't remember it.
Yeah. Do you like the movie Top Gun?
Is Kelly McGillis going to be back now that she's a lesbian? I mean,
the and whole she finally breaks up with Tom Cruise because she's changing teams.
Well, yeah. maybe Kelly McGillis, since she came out after, she could encourage Tom Cruise to come out.
Oh, yeah.
And that would be like a whole new surprise ending to Top Gun sequel.
They all fly away together.
Yeah.
Do they're happy. Oh, life is all about rainbows and unicorns.
Yeah.
I feel the need for speed.
I mean, did you ever hear the Quentin Tarantino explanation of Top Gun being essentially a metaphor for homosexuality?
Oh, really? I didn't know.
No, the Quentin Tarantino distillation of Top Gun is, I'll pull it. It's pretty hysterical.
Really? Okay.
And shockingly accurate. No, I don't miss Highway to the Danger Zone. Best Kenny Loggins song?
Whenever I Call You Friend?
No.
Which one?
Conviction of the Heart.
Oh, Conviction. That's great. Well, yeah, when parents are getting divorced, you just sit the kids down and play Conviction of the Heart.
Is that an official divorce song?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
That we love you, but mommy and daddy, you know,
don't love each other anymore. We hate each other.
Now I'm going to take her for all she's worth. In the key of G.
I'm going to take her for all she's worth?
Yeah, because sometimes that happens, and sometimes the women mostly take the man for all he's
right.
worth.
Right. I'm glad you used
the
effort
mostly.
Well,
no, I have friends that the husbands are getting spousal support.
Well, I mean, the friends you have, I mean, they're, you know, those aren't men, really. I mean, they have male parts, but they're not really men.
They take spousal support from their wife.
Speaking of androgyny, 10 things you need to know about Harvard graduates.
Okay.
These are going to be the people that lord over us, right? So you want to know a little bit about them. Harvard University, the Crimson, the student newspaper, did a close-up survey of recent Harvard grads to give a bit of a profile of them, these titans, for us, the peons. Number one, it's an anxious generation. Among the class of 2018, 41% have at some point sought mental health support from the university's health services. 4 in 10 Harvard grads have sought mental health services.
Well, they're under a lot of pressure. They have to be perfect.
So is everybody. These are the...
But they're special.
You want people in charge of all of these cultural institutions that are as tightly wound as this? 41% mental health services? More than 1 in 5 leave Harvard as virgins. The others are sexually harassed. I don't know if one is connected to the other. More than 1 in 5 leave Harvard as virgins.
That's good. That's admirable.
I don't know that it's by choice, but okay. More than a fifth of the new graduates reported having been sexually harassed. So you've got a fifth that are virgins and a fifth that have been sexually harassed. You think it's the virgin sexually harassing the others? I don't know.
It could be. All right, what else you got for me?
72% say the U.S. is going in the wrong direction.
Of course they do.
Yeah, right.
Trump's in power.
Correct. Only 3% of 2018 Harvard grads.
I bet they're social outcasts.
Backed Trump. Two-thirds describe themselves as liberal or very liberal. They're very afraid of speech that may offend. Two-thirds of students at Harvard, right, the big brains, the deep intellects, two-thirds said they had at some point chosen not to express an opinion in an academic setting out of fear that it would offend others. Here's somebody who's never afraid to express an opinion out of a fear that it may offend. Sean from Elmwood Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to me. First of all, anyone who's strapped on nylon parachute pants, you don't get to talk about the 80s.
That was part of the 80s.
Flipping around. The whole thing is the 80s. What are you talking about? Top Gun, Val Kilmer. It's all the generation you wish you were good enough to be in. But you're in that sissy generation where nylon pants and flipping around on cardboard seemed to be a good idea at the time.
Breakdancing was part of the 80s culture.
Never in Melrose Park. You'd end up in your tighty whities with a couple of lumps on your head. You come in there with parachute pants, for God's sake.
All the cool... Sean, you wore parachute pants.
So, never wore parachute pants.
He wore the Cavaricci's and the and the Chess King.
It's the generation after ours.
Did you have an Italian horn?
Yeah, with his Chess King, the Chess King rugby shirts. You know those.
No, Sean King.
We're the last generation to dress and act like men. Now I want to tell you something else.
Wait a second. Hold on a second.
Did you or did you not wear an Italian horn?
No, I'm only half Italian. I just get the chain. I don't get anything.
What's the other half?
He's Norwegian.
Norwegian.
You know what?
That's right.
You know what Italian?
We get along.
Hold on a second.
On another island.
You know what? Fine. You know what Italians call someone who's half Italian and half Norwegian?
Half. What?
Oh, yeah, I can't wait to find out. Go ahead.
Norwegian.
That might be the truth. But listen, I wanted to tell you something because, number one, I was right when I told you Rauner would step down because he'd realize how he didn't stand a chance because he's a fraud. Fraud, married to another scarecrow. Doesn't stand a chance. He's going to step down. And all this talk about who's going to replace it. Why isn't it Jeannie Ives? Seeing how she's the only other Republican. What do you mean she doesn't want it? I don't care what she wants. I told her to do it. What do you mean you don't want it?
Yeah,
you're the one. We got all the votes.
Yeah,
she's right. The only Republican to get other votes. She is the natural. If he steps down, she better get in there.
Right,
or
thanks.
I'm going to Pat Brady's house with toilet paper. We'll tie him up like a mummy because it's outrageous. We're going to get another one of these failures in there. It's despicable, for God's sakes. And the guy who's expanding Medicare that you're making fun of,
it's imploding. Review of the entire show. Yeah, go ahead.
That's the Republican idea. That's exactly what they're doing in Illinois. They expand things as they implode and tell you how good it is for you.
All right. Sean, I got a last question for you. Are you sending either one of your girls to Harvard now that you've gotten a little bit of a sense of the type of individuals
you
are there?
You got inside baseball because I don't care where they go just so it's far away. Pick a school that's far.
Bye, Sean. What about you?
You think he's amped up a little?
What about you, Peyton and Eli?
Oh, they're Harvard? Going to Harvard, please.
Ralph and Rantoul, your kids going to Harvard?
No, good morning. Her ACT score was high enough to get to Harvard, but she had no interest.
Yeah, there you go.
Hey, the thing, I don't know what's on the list, but here's number 11. Any Harvard grad will tell you he or she's a Harvard grad within approximately 5 seconds after opening his or her mouth.
Yes, that's right.
Every single time, every day. I had a Harvard grad, MBA Harvard grad, work for me as a salesperson for about 2 years. Every single day when I was at Harvard, finally I said, look, two things. Number one, I remember that you went to Harvard. Number two, go out and actually sell something, would you? And shut up.
It's like from Michigan. You never have to ask because they're always wearing the Michigan gear. You know that they went to Michigan. You know who went to Harvard, though, who never told or bragged about it or was braggadocious, I should say? Lauren Jiggetts. One day, because she was in my pod at Channel 5, and one day I'm like, you know what, I never, because I, you know, me, Miss Iowa, like, where did you go to school? And she said, I went to Harvard. Like, you went to Harvard? Why don't you tell people that? She said, because it's all right.
Yeah, she's smart, which separates her from most other people in television news. She probably knows a lot of these things about Harvard, and she's not proud of it.
Graduated a long time
ago. So here's a Harvard grad, Mark Zuckerberg.
Oh, that's right.
He went back and got his degree.
Oh, that's right, because he left because he created Facebook.
Yeah, there you go. Facebook is getting into the news business. They announced yesterday their first slate of funded news shows for Facebook Watch. This is, you know, they're combating, taking Ben Rhodes' advice from the Obama administration, getting into your news feeds and combating what they determined to be fake news or less than credible news organizations. And by that, I mean, of course, conservative. Here are the news shows funded by Facebook, funded for and by Facebook Watch.
Conservative crush.
ABC News is on location, a daily news show with ABC News journalists from around the globe delivering on-the-ground reporting.
Okay.
CNN's Anderson Cooper Full Circle.
Oh, boy.
Oh, Fox News. Oh, it's balanced, right? Fox News Update with Shepard Smith.
Oh, because no way. Are you serious?
Uh-huh.
That's the show they chose?
Univision's Real America with Jorge Ramos.
Oh, my God.
Can you sense any pattern with the news shows that are going to be posted for viewing on Facebook Watch? Do you get any sense of a particular worldview? The Weltanschauung of the...
Excuse you.
of the Facebook Facebook Watch programs. Did you? Is there anything you pick up on with this?
It's all liberal hacks.
There it is. But right, that's real news. And anybody that disagrees with the D.C. press corps and all of its allied outlets in big cities like Chicago, they're fake news. Understand?
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
I just want to sum up the Harvard story since we got rudely interrupted by Sean from Elmwood Park. So a composite profile of 2018 Harvard grads, if you're thinking about sending your kid to Harvard. The composite is a cheating, mentally ill sexual harasser who self-medicates with booze, is afraid to speak their mind, and votes to plunder you. That's what the Ivy League is producing.
Okay.
That's our best and brightest.
Some sad news, the end of an era. I don't know if you heard, but the last living munchkin from the 1939 film Wizard of Oz has passed away. And I have, nice thing, is it an Illinois Democrat?
Yeah, those munchkins are still very much alive, unfortunately.
Jerry Marin passed away at the age of 98. You may remember him. He made a number of appearances in the film, but he's the one who gave the lollipop to Dorothy in the movie. And he was the president of the Lollipop Guild. They always creep me out. I don't like little people. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Well, they
frighten you?
Little ankle biters.
Yeah.
Because I'm a beast. I'm really tall, so I was always afraid of them when I watched The Wizard.
The little people aren't here to hurt you.
Are you sure?
Yeah, they're fine. Well. Except for the Shetland Democrats in charge of Illinois.
I mean, really, when you look at all of them, Quigley, I mean, they're tiny little people.
Chicago Democrats have sort of ruined the Munchkin brand. I mean, Madigan, Cullerton, Rahm, Daly.
Bill Daly's tall.
They're all Cornish people. The people that are in charge. There's no question. Munchkins. I don't want to put them in the same category as Jerry Marin. I mean, you love the Munchkins. You just hate the Munchkin Chicago Democrats. That's yes. All.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.